Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back. Hamish, my Hello. Friend, happy birthday.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah. I'm 25. I'm right on the
25.
I'm right on the middle of my 20s now, so, you know what they say, it's all
welcome
downhill from here
to the mid 20s. It is, my friend. Oh, I'm 28. Great.
No, you're supposed
I'm
to say
starting to stiffen up.
You're supposed to say no, Hamish, it gets better. You're supposed to, you know.
No, it gets worse.
Great. Awesome. Happy birthday.
Right. Oh, dear. No, that's what the trait of the investor. You have to be realistic.
Yeah.
You can't be off with the fairies. You have to be grounded in reality.
Mm.
Hamish, it does get hard. This is a depressing start to the podcast.
Jesus.
As you get older, you will suffer.
Jeez. I was having a good birthday.
Did you do anything for your birthday?
I was having a good birthday until this podcast started. No. I just caught up with some friends. nothing crazy. I feel like, it just gets birthdays. They come around so much quicker now, so it's not like it doesn't seem like such a big deal anymore. It was pretty quiet, but I took a few days off work just to kind of reset because it's good because my birthday's in the middle of the year, so it's also just a nice excuse to just take a few days off and just shut everything out and just chill out for a little bit. So that's what I've been doing over the past week, pretty much.
Nice. What was it? Just a few days off. When was your last YouTube video, mate?
It was a while ago. Okay.
Just a few days
ago. It's coming, guys. It's coming.
It's coming. what a joke.
Yeah.
What a joke. The reference is when we're in Vegas and we're walking through the casinos, Hamish would just turn to me occasionally and go, "Don't worry, it's coming. I can feel it. It's coming. It's coming." Hamish, did your streak ever come?
My streak of what?
Of Las Vegas winnings?
No, it's still coming. It's coming. Yeah. We'll go back. You see, you have to lose the first time you go, and then it's the second time that you go, which is...
Oh, right. I don't know what sort of philosophy that is, but I don't like it.
You're making me sound like a degenerate gambler.
No, you're not. You're not.
No.
Well, I'd never played any of those games before. I'd never played blackjack before. I'd never played roulette or anything. So it was interesting. I feel like going to Vegas, you have to at least experience what it's like. So we experienced how casinos make money. We did experience that.
Yeah.
And now we know firsthand that yes, that is a thing. They do take your money.
Well, it is kind of annoying that most places the minimum bets now in Vegas are like $25 US. I think there was a couple that were like $15 US, but for someone who, like, I enjoy playing blackjack, but I don't want to bet more than $1 at a time or even like $5 at a time. I just like betting a little bit and kind of just enjoying playing because it's kind of fun. You get to do some maths in your head and that sort of thing, which for most people probably isn't fun, but I kind of enjoy it. But I don't want to bet $25, $50, especially US dollars at a time and just knowing that I'm going to lose, therefore, like, probably hundreds of dollars. So it is kind of annoying that there was only a couple of places really where you could bet, you know, kind of small amounts. But yeah,
that was hectic actually, watching some of the high roller tables, and the minimum bet is like $25, $50. That is crazy. And I know blackjack's one of those ones where you don't, you know, lose your money straight away. Like roulette, you can pretty much just lose your money straight away. But blackjack, you know, you're in there for a while because you almost win as many as you lose. Obviously not, but you almost do. So it does drag on. But even still, seeing people lose a hand that's worth $50 USD.
Yeah.
And then that's the thing with blackjack. Hands are so fast.
Mm.
It's over in a flash. And then already you're playing the next one. Already you're playing the next one.
Yeah.
So it happens all very quickly. Yeah.
Hmm. There you go.
But anyway.
Took us back to Vegas.
Welcome to the Young Gamblers Podcast, sponsored by Sportsbet. Do you love the horses? Yeah. Do you love the races?
That's really funny.
Oh, what about the dogs?
Yeah, no, we've...
We're definitely not sponsored by Sportsbet, everybody.
No,
No. That would be interesting.
Yeah, maybe we'll look into that.
I don't think it quite aligns. No, we should not. Hamish, stop. Stop.
No. Definitely not.
Okay, what are we talking about today, Hamish? What are we talking about in this completely dead news week?
Yeah, it's a quiet news week. We've got, you know, some of our regular inflation and rate decision news. So out of the US this time, we've got inflation data and rate hike news. Bit of a recession. A couple of countries around the world, or a couple of regions, I should say, falling into recession over the past week. So we'll talk about those. There was a big IPO this week, a fast-growing restaurant chain, which I'll talk about because it is a massive multi-billion dollar IPO. We haven't seen one of those in a little while.
Interesting.
And what have you got for us?
I'm going to talk about Gary Gensler, the SEC chair. He sat down with the Journal just to talk about this crypto crackdown. So there's a couple of quotes in there as to what they're doing. And then I saw an interesting article on the Daily Upside, which is about activist investors actually doing remarkably well in 2023 based on a rule that was changed. But honestly, apart from that, it's not a lot going on.
Yeah.
There is not a lot. Sometimes we get really busy news weeks. Sometimes we get really quiet ones. This is one of those really quiet ones.
Yep.
So
pretty much.
Prepare to listen to absolute and utter fluff from both of us for the next hour.
No. There is a great story in the middle of this that you can't miss. So make sure you stick
you
it out.
You won't
want to
miss.
Yeah. All right. Today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application you could use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. So you can bring in all of your trades either automatically by connecting your broker, or you can bring in your trades manually using Excel or one by one. And when you do that, it will track all the gains and losses in your portfolio. So capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans, it will do those calculations for you. Currency gains if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies. And then you can also use it for when it comes to tax time, which is upon us in Australia. If you're an Australian resident, ShareSite generates up to 12 different reports that can be used at tax time to work out things such as capital gains, dividend income, and more. At the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/young investors. That's site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSite.com/young investors. So use that link, sign up to a free plan. You can track up to 10 holdings for as long as you want, or you can sign up using that link to a more premium plan for more premium features, and you'll get 4 months off an annual subscription if you do so. And as always, thank you to those who sign up to ShareSite using our link and are supporting the podcast.
Woohoo.
All right, which exciting piece All of news right, should Hamish. We start off with today?
Where do we start? Yep. We start with, let's do US inflation and rate decision.
Yep.
I reckon.
It's probably, this is probably...
I actually haven't heard this. I haven't heard what happened yet. I'm going in blind. Very rare for me.
Yeah.
Normally I see it, but I actually haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I think there's just so many. Now like, it's like every week there's something. Someone's reporting inflation, or someone's got a rate hike happening, or someone's in a recession. So it's hard to keep up on top of all of
them. Half of the course.
Yeah. But this was probably the most mainstream piece of news, I think, in the finance world. So it's probably quite important to cover it. Inflation in the US continued to fall, dropping to... Do you want to have a guess? Their inflation last month came in at 4.9%, and it has continued to fall. Have a guess for me?
4.5? I don't know.
It came in at 4% flat, which is pretty good.
Wow.
That's a pretty healthy number. Obviously, still above the...
That's not bad.
Yeah, not bad. Still above the 1 to 3% range that would be in an ideal place. But 4% is certainly, quite a good number. It's actually the lowest inflation rate in the US in 2 full years. So clearly, some of the Federal Reserve's work with interest rate hikes, which we'll talk about in a little bit because they also had a decision on that. Clearly, some of that is having, or at least appears to be having, a reasonable impact on the headline inflation figure. In terms of the biggest contributors to the decline, looking at some of the specific lines within the inflation figure inside the consumer price index, gasoline was negative 20% year over year. So energy continues to be, declines in energy continues to be the biggest positive to the overall inflation figure at the moment. Health insurance came down 20%. Airfares came down 13%. Yeah, it was interesting to see that because vehicle insurance was actually up 17%. So you've got vehicle insurance rising, but health insurance declining. So I don't know, does anyone in the insurance space know what causes the difference in those two? That'd be interesting to see. But airfares came down 13%, which that's not surprising. One of the biggest costs, of course, for airlines is gasoline. So when energy prices and oil prices, I should say, are coming down, then it makes sense that some of that's going to get passed on to the customer in lower airfares. And then car and truck rentals was the other big one, minus 13% year over year. So those are kind of the big declines. And within the overall inflation figure, even though, and this has kind of been the story recently, which is that even though the headline number is going down, there are some components within inflation that are still very, very strong. So some of the biggest contributors to inflation increasing still were vehicle repair and insurance. So vehicle repair was plus 20%. And as I said, vehicle insurance was plus 17%. Pet food was plus 15%. And frozen fruit and veg, just frozen fruit and veg was up 13%. So
crazy.
There you go. There's some really odd categories when you go down like very specific things. Yeah, there you go. So those were some of the kind of the bigger contributors to inflation. And then it's always interesting to look at core inflation, which strips out the volatile food and energy segments. Because as of recently, we've just seen big declines in energy. So it kind of makes sense to see how the rest is looking. Core inflation was still quite strong at 5.3%, coming down slightly from 5.5% last month. So same story as last month. Core inflation is now above overall inflation because the food and energy categories are actually negative. They're actually in deflation. And you also have core inflation coming down, but being a little bit more resilient, not coming down as fast as the overall kind of headline number.
Right.
So
makes sense.
So yeah, there you go. Pretty positive news, I would say, overall. You know, 5.3% core inflation is still very, very strong. And if you look at some of the categories, there is quite a bit of resilience, unfortunately. So some of those categories will have to continue to come down. But yeah, you certainly can't complain about headline inflation going from over 9% to 4% in the space of about a year, I guess.
It's just a crazy difference in how we feel about 4% inflation now.
Yeah.
On the way up, it felt like, oh my God, this is hyperinflation.
Yeah.
And now that we're coming back down from 9, 10% back down to 4%, it's like, oh, this feels good. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, 4%.
It's still two times the normal rate, though. Still two times what the Fed wants, though. So we got a ways to go.
Yeah, and you know, 4% is a lot. I mean, if you think of it in terms of can my job, can my income be sustainable with the rising cost of living, then, you know, 4% is a pretty considerable pay rise to be getting every single year, just, you know, on average, looking at all jobs. So, you know, it is still an impact. So it would be good to see that continue to come down. And of course, the biggest and main lever that that the US is using the Federal Reserve is using to get inflation under control is the raising of interest rates. And they actually made a decision this week. They made their monthly decision and they decided to hold rates flat. So they did not decide to increase. They are keeping rates at the current 5.25% level. Mr. Jerome Powell had this to say: "We have raised our policy interest rate by 5 percentage points, and we've continued to reduce our security holdings at a brisk pace. We've covered a lot of ground, and the full effects of our tightening have yet to be felt." But they also said that they will probably do two more rate hikes at some point later this year. So clearly they think they've done quite a bit of work on the interest rate side, and that there is potentially this kind of delayed effect between their rate hikes and how consumers react, and therefore, you know, the inflation figure coming down. So they decided to pause, which was interesting to see, but also not super surprising considering how good the latest inflation data was.
Yeah, I mean, if they're holding the rates at 5.25% and then inflation is just ding, 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 like it's coming down, then I don't think they need to pile on more pressure. That's kind of what Elon Musk was saying. It's like these things take time. You know, he was seeing this before inflation had before we got those inflation releases, when inflation started to come down. He was saying you don't need to do too much more because I can already see that inflation is coming down. Obviously, with his background in manufacturing of cars, he could see that happening. So it's like he actually said at the time, Fed, don't raise rates. It's silly. You're just piling on the pain. Inflation is coming down. Just let it run down. So
yeah,
I think that's interesting. So that's now what they're doing. They see that inflation is just steadily coming down. So they're just like, all right, we're just going to stay here for a bit. And hopefully that trend continues. And then another month will pass, and or however long it is till their next meeting, and I guess they'll make another decision based on what's going on at the time.
Yep. Yeah, I mean that's basically it. That's the balance that the Fed is trying the tough balance that they've got to make, which is they want to raise interest rates enough to get inflation under control, but they also don't want to push the US into a deep recession if it's not necessary. So yeah, I guess next month we'll see how inflation continues to trend, and what the Fed decides to do from there.
Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely not in the business of intentionally trying to punish people, you know?
No. I mean, not.
Yeah, like it's unfortunate that the way to get inflation down is to financially restrict people.
Yeah.
But they're not going out there with ill intent, like, haha, we are going to inflict this pain on you now. They don't want to inflict pain. Jerome doesn't want to go down in history as the biggest pain inflictor of all time.
No.
He was the guy that destroyed, remember how you had that mortgage that you then couldn't afford? He doesn't want to be that guy. So they definitely don't want to make it worse than what it has to be. Sometimes it just has to be, like Paul Volcker. He had to do it. He had to break the inflation cycles. But they don't actually want to pile on the pain.
Yeah. It's got to be an incredibly difficult job to do, to be in that position. And just the constant media, you know, barrage, basically questioning every single move you make. And it's a job where it's almost impossible to make perfect decisions. There's always going to be some kind of negative outcome that's likely to happen. It's always kind of doing something and then you have the effect you want, but it's exaggerated. So then you have to go back the other way and then you get the effect you want, but it swings too hard that way. So it's very rare that they're able to make a decision and it works out perfectly. So it's an incredibly difficult job that they have to do. Mm.
Yeah. Did you want to keep rolling on into this recession data is kind of related, or do you want to switch gears for a bit? What do you feel?
Let's switch gears. Give us one of your stories, and then we'll circle back.
Okay, sure. I'll talk about just quickly. The Wall Street Journal spoke to SEC Chair Gary Gensler on the crypto crackdown that was taking news headlines last week. It says here, last week the SEC took steps to regulate the crypto industry. They're suing Binance and Coinbase for illegally operating as unregistered exchanges.
Yep.
And I thought this was actually a podcast, so I'm scraping quotes from a podcast here, but I thought it was actually quite interesting. It's like 16 minutes long. It's on the Wall Street Journal's website. I think their podcast is just called The Journal. But yeah, he says, I've seen some non-compliance from time to time in traditional finance, but I've never seen a whole field so built upon non-compliance with law. And quite frankly, that's what a lot of the business model is. So he's clearly not happy with the space. He wants them to fall in line. This is obviously talking about whether crypto is regulated as a security, and the SEC's argument is that most certainly cryptocurrency is a security and will be treated as such under the law. And then you've got the other side of the equation, which are the crypto exchanges arguing the opposite. So yep. we'll see who wins that battle. But my money is it is definitely a security. So we'll see.
I mean, if you have any battle between X party and the US government,
yeah. I mean, yeah, pretty much.
I think you back the US government. Yeah, I think the SEC is probably going to get their way on this. But it will be interesting to see how it all kind of falls.
Yeah, and where like the technical definitions lie, that will be the interesting thing. Like what's like a point of contention or whatever, and what's just like obvious. But anyway, he said when somebody is raising money from the public, they owe the public full, fair, and truthful disclosure. When they're running an exchange, they need to have proper protections. In terms of their organization, the business model in crypto is based on commingling or bundling a bunch of functions that are normally separated in traditional finance. The New York Stock Exchange does not also own a hedge fund or a market maker trading against you. Mm. What we alleged in Binance and in Coinbase is that they were bundling up multiple functions that were traditionally separated. For good reason, they're separated. We would never allow that for the New York Stock Exchange.
Interesting.
Yeah, so there you go. Obviously, you don't want conflicts of interest to arise, you know? You don't want to say, "Hey, we've got this secure platform, give us your data," and then go and sell that data on to somebody else who's paying you money for it. That's obviously not great, and they don't want to do that. They don't want to do that in any industry, particularly in crypto. They don't want they don't want you to sign up to their platforms and then the hedge funds are actually trading against you, the crypto exchange is trading against you.
Yeah, well, that's what makes the finance industry so complicated, is because it's, you know, in some aspects it's a place where clients are supposed to be able to get a professional opinion and you're supposed to be working on behalf of your client, but it's also an industry where there's a lot of self-interest involved, and those conflicts of interest come up a lot, and that's why it's one of the most heavily regulated industries, especially because the consequences for everyday people is severe if there's an error made by somebody or fraud committed by somebody. It's not like if Nike's shoes break, then that's, you know, sure, you have a bad pair of shoes and you're out $200, but you could lose tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in some of these cases. So it's super important that it's very closely scrutinized.
The podcast noted, in the trading of stocks and bonds, exchanges and brokerages are separate, like the New York Stock Exchange is separate from Charles Schwab. But in the crypto world, Coinbase and Binance they perform both functions, which can lead to conflicts of interest. The SEC also alleges that cryptocurrencies, sometimes called coins or tokens, are functioning as securities under the law. Gensler said, "It's still an investment contract under our laws. The law is clear. If you're raising money from the public and the public's making an investment based on your efforts, therein lies a relationship, one might say, but it's technically called an investment contract."
Right.
You are making an investment. It is a security.
Makes sense.
They also went on to talk about, did the collapse of FTX create more urgency for you? To which he said, "I think the relevance of FTX is that it showed for the investing public how fraught it is to have these functions so bundled up, and how fraught it is to have non-compliant crypto exchanges. But no one should assume that other bundled crypto service platforms, so-called crypto exchanges, are better protected. You're not getting the full, fair, and truthful disclosure. You've got platforms against which you're trading. They're both a hedge fund trading against you. They might be borrowing against your assets. They might not even be keeping your assets. We allege in Binance that you may have thought your funds or crypto were custodied here in the US, and it's not so clear that they were. We allege in Binance that it had a great amount of deception and concealment about where your funds and crypto were, that they were commingling the house funds with your funds. I would suggest you'd want to be very careful. And if somebody's not giving you disclosure, you should always ask yourself, why aren't they willing to give me the disclosures I deserve under the law I'm supposed to get? Why isn't that crypto trading platform properly separating my funds and putting them remote from the bankruptcy? So all good questions.
Yeah, it's...
And this is exactly what FTX... This is why FTX blew up, didn't they?
Yeah, and I mean, I think the truth with a lot of these platforms is you just don't know, and it's impossible to know. And it's why I've always just had this aversion to... You know, partly I'm not investing in crypto because they're not cash flowing assets. That's kind of one element. But the other element is I just don't trust my money in some of these places. And, you know, maybe that's overly cautious.
And if you're not sure, like...
Yeah, all I was going to say is, you know, most of these platforms are probably doing things quite well and managing behind the scenes quite well. But you just don't know, and it's so unregulated that no one's looking at the moment. No one's, well, at least now they're starting to actually, you know, take a look.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. I had a bit of lag. So I thought you were done talking, so I jumped in, but you were not talking. So my apologies. I was going to say, just to round out that topic, you know, if you're not sure about an investment that you're making, don't make it. Full stop. That's like Warren Buffett's rule number one is don't lose money. Don't lose money. Right. So if you feel like, oh, I'd like to get into crypto and, you know, Binance, it sounds legit, but I'm not really 100% sure. And if you can't find disclosures as to how your money's being handled, then the best practice or the safest practice is to just let it pass. Just not do anything. Same goes for a stock. You know, if you're trying to research a business and you have these questions about, you know, how they're running the business, how much debt they're taking. These are just numbers you can find. But let's say that they're being a bit sketchy. They're not providing you the full color that you want to try and figure things out. You just let that one go. You're like, look, sorry. It looks good, but I don't know for sure. So I've got to let it pass. So I think that's a very important rule. Very important rule. Don't lose money. If you're not sure, don't do it.
100%.
Yeah. That's about all I had to say. That was Gary Gensler on the Journal podcast. Let's talk about major countries fall into recession as the world blows up. Nuclear war is imminent.
Okay.
And the stock market loses 99%.
Okay, that's not what's happening.
All right, maybe not.
Calm down, all right?
All right, I'm calm. Sorry.
We do. We have a couple of... there's a lot of countries around the world that are already in recession, but, you know, we're not going to kind of be keeping track of every country or else this whole podcast would just be recession and inflation. But there are a couple of countries that are relevant to us, one of them being New Zealand, which is our down under neighbor here in Oceania. They are now in a technical recession. So New Zealand's gross domestic product fell 0.1% in the first quarter, which is why technical should be really bolded there.
Yeah.
Because they barely satisfied their requirements. So of course the technical recession occurs when there's two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. Negative growth is kind of a funny way of putting it, but that's the way that it's described. So growth fell 0.1% in the first quarter, and that came after they fell 0.7% in the previous quarter. This article says, they fell 0.1% according to government data, as the central bank embarked on one of the most aggressive rate hike cycles in the world. So they've been kind of leading the pack in terms of interest rate hikes. Their interest rate is at 5.5%, which, as we kind of mentioned earlier, is actually higher than the US. But unfortunately, despite that, they still have relatively high inflation. So inflation is at 6.7%. So they're in kind of this tricky position where They're now technically in a recession. They've had, you know, negative GDP growth for two consecutive quarters, but they still have reasonably high inflation. And, you know, that's like the worst kind of situation that countries can can really be in, because if inflation is high, that means people are suffering from the rising cost of living, cost of living pressures, which means the central bank should be raising rates. But on the other side, if the economy is in recession, it's probably going to be a tougher job market, you know, companies making less revenue, therefore laying people off. So ideally, you'd want the central bank to be cutting interest rates and kind of relieving pressure on both individuals, but also businesses, so that they can hire people back. So you've kind of got this rock and a hard place situation that New Zealand is in, which is very difficult. But yeah, emphasis on technical, because yeah, they actually fell less than they did in the previous quarter. So hopefully the worst is behind them, but you never really know.
This is kind of what Ray Dalio has been talking about all along, I guess, with his stagflation. Stagflation just being really high inflation in an economy that is not performing, that is struggling. Because, yeah, normally you get high inflation in booming economies. But this is because of all that's happened with, I guess, really the main thing that's triggered it is supply shocking over the past couple of years with all the pandemic stuff. That you get this stagflation, kind of what happened after the oil shocks in the 70s, supply shock, and then you get that high inflation, but also economic weakness. And it's a particularly tough it's a tough thing to cope with, because they've got to jack rates up, but you're jacking rates up on people that are already struggling. So you get double hardship, which is not great.
Yeah, it's kind of a counterintuitive situation, because if a country is in recession, it means businesses are making less money, it means people are spending less, and that should mean that prices should be going down. But sometimes you can get in this, as you said, this weird situation where you have businesses not performing well, consumers cutting back on spending, but because you have these supply bottlenecks that can take time to work out, you have really low supply, which even as kind of demand is coming down, it's so imbalanced that there's still inflation, even though, you know, demand is kind of cooling, which is what a recession is. So it is kind of a unique, weird situation. As you said, Ray Dalio has covered this a lot. So it's a fascinating thing to learn about, especially if you're in one of these countries and it's what you're experiencing. It's good to understand kind of the mechanics of how these things work.
And then we're off to the Eurozone.
We are. So very similar situation, a little bit different to New Zealand, but yes, Eurozone is also now in a technical recession. So according to revised data revealed on Thursday, the Eurozone economy shrank by 0.1%, same as New Zealand, technically have emphasis on technical, in the first quarter of this year, following a shrinkage in the final quarter of last year. So there you go, you get your two consecutive negative GDP growth quarters. Eurozone is kind of a funny one, because it includes, I believe, 20 countries. So it's not as if we're kind of zooming in on one particular country. It's a whole region. So there's always discussion of, well, which countries are growing well and which ones are kind of lagging. So you have Italy, Spain, and France, who all carried their weight towards economic growth. So the Italian, the Spanish, and the French economies are all growing very well. Germany suffered a significant slowdown in factory output in March, so they were one of the contributors to the decline. And then Ireland, I think, was the worst of the bunch, with a 4.6% drop in first quarter GDP, which is a massive decline to happen just over the course of 3 months. So you do get this weird mix of some countries doing well, some countries doing okay, and some countries doing really poorly, and it kind of combines to form, well, the Eurozone result. And then kind of similar to New Zealand, they have inflation of 7%, or they did in April. And I think it's expected to come down over the next month, but it is still very high. So you've got the exact same situation where you have a technical recession, you've got businesses, producing less, consumers spending less, but you've still got this underlying inflation. And it's particularly in Europe, a lot of that is associated with the supply shocks out of the conflict going on in Ukraine. and the impacts that's had on energy prices. The main difference between Eurozone and New Zealand is New Zealand has been very aggressive with interest rate hikes, whereas Europe has not. So it will be very interesting to see how the EU or the ECB, the European Central Bank, decides to deal with this situation, because it is very difficult. They have to decide how to set interest rates, and those interest rates are kind of applied broadly across 20 different countries that have 20 different economic circumstances. So it's kind of an odd situation, and it's definitely more difficult than, you know, a smaller country, which you know, like New Zealand, where there really isn't, you know, that big of a population, and it's all, you know, the economy wouldn't vary too much from place to place.
Yep. Don't think I have anything to add on that one. Sorry, I'm kind of just sitting here and nodding because we're in one of those traps where we've got so much lag that we end up talking over each other a little bit. So I just have to kind of be a bit of a passenger. So my apologies, but we're doing our best over here.
Yeah.
Anything else to talk about in terms of technical recessions in New Zealand and Eurozone, or should we move on?
No, that's just about it. So hopefully no more recession news. Hopefully that's it.
No more.
No, we'll leave it there. No, that's it. Yeah, take us take us through what you've got next.
All right. Just an interesting article that I thought that I saw on the Daily Upside, which is that activist investors are winning more than they normally do at the moment, and there might be a reason behind it. They say, have you noticed that activist investors are more active and maybe successful lately? Data shared with Axios suggests that activist investors are tasting victory on a more regular basis, thanks in part to a new SEC policy that makes board voting less black and white, allowing shareholders to select from a buffet of nominees to put forward by both the company and agitators rather than order the set menu. So activist investors, of course, are investors who buy a minority stake in companies, and then they run some sort of campaign to try and persuade other shareholders to back their vision for the company. The most aggressive step an activist can take, short of corporate raiding, is nominating a new candidate for a board position and asking shareholders to vote out the incumbent at the annual shareholder meeting in a proxy fight.
Yeah.
So they're trying to get some influence and push the company in maybe a different direction that they think is better, is a better way to go. And they try and convince people that that's the way to go. Investor activism started this year with a bang. In the first 3 months of 2023, activist investors around the world had their most active quarter ever.
Wow.
Now the US proxy season is drawing to a close. The data suggests that activist investors' success rates are creeping up. This is partly to do with a rule brought in last September by the SEC called the Universal Proxy Card, UPC. Prior to the UPC, if an activist investor wanted to replace directors on a company's board, two proxy cards would be sent to shareholders. One card would have the slate of directors being nominated by the activists, and the other would be the board as suggested by the company's management. Shareholders could only send in one card, meaning that you either voted for all the people backed by the company or all the folks backed by the activists. The UPC changed that, meaning shareholders can now mix and match nominees from both camps. So that makes sense, because typically most people will just be like, they don't pay that much attention. They'll be like, you know, the company's doing all right, we'll side with the company. Most people just vote in that direction, but now it gives them a little bit more pick and choose. Capability. So data given to Axios by investor voting data company Insightia showed that although this year's proxy season has seen fewer activist-backed nominees elected to company boards, the proportion of successful nominations is higher than last year. In 2022, 47% of nominations resulted in a win, compared to 66% this year. So that's quite a significant difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. That rule change seems to make sense. I mean, it does make sense that you would want to, as a shareholder, have a little bit more control over who you nominate for being on the board. So it makes sense that you don't actually just have to pick from what management is suggesting and then the complete suggestion from the activists. So it makes sense. And it also makes perfect sense why that would contribute to more success. Because, you know, an activist might be suggesting a number of changes to the board, but potentially they get a portion of those changes through rather than their entire wish.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yep. More pick and choosing equals the chance that maybe just one of those activist directors gets on the board. For companies, the silver lining is that having a smattering of dissident directors on your board is better than shareholders overhauling the entire thing. That makes sense as well. Activist investors don't always need to rely on democracy for a win. The data given to Axios also indicated a higher rate of settlements between companies and activist investors, and Sunday saw a major move as Francis D'Souza, CEO of biotech company Illumina, stepped down following a long crusade from high-profile activist investor Carl Icahn. Right. Carl Icahn, he's the classic, isn't he? He used to do this all the time. Does he still do it all the time?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's always been his thing, is find companies.
That's his shtick.
That's his thing. He finds companies where he thinks that there's potential for maybe, you know, aggressive share repurchases or an increase in the dividend, or they could do a merger with another company, or they could sell a part to another company. He looks for these opportunities, and then he uses his enormous wealth to force the management team out and force them to do what he will bring in people he wants in that position. And he's been, I haven't actually looked at Carl Icahn's history all that closely. He's been very successful at what he does over time. I'd love to take a look at his track record at some of the things. The only one I'm aware of was that he did, came into Blockbuster right around the time that they were trying to fight Netflix, and that didn't work out very well for him.
Right.
But I believe he has a very good track record, but that's the only specific example that I can think of.
I have to correct myself because this article has a horrific typo of the company name. It is Illumina.
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 Okay.
Yeah. The typo is Illumina. So it is not that. That's why I got so thrown off trying to pronounce it. I had to check it.
That's funny.
But no, I was right. Illumina. All right. There we go. Something that just caught my attention. Nothing crazy. Slow news week, but thought it might be interesting to talk about. What else you got for us, Hamish?
Let's talk about a new IPO. We don't really talk about IPOs all that much, but it is interesting to see which companies are coming on the market. And there hasn't been a lot recently because, you know, the way it kind of goes with IPOs is when everything's all, when everything's really, everything's going well, interest rates are low, stock prices are at all-time highs, then the IPOs are flowing. And it makes sense the private shareholders recognize this is a good opportunity to sell our stock for a premium. You don't want to sell your stock for pennies on the dollar during a recession or something like that. That was kind of the, I think, I'm guessing 2021 had to have been the peak of IPOs. 2021, it seemed like every single company was IPO. I think Coinbase IPO'd in 2021. I think, did Airbnb IPO? There was a lot. There was an enormous amount.
Even just around that 2019 to 2021 there were just a boatload of IPOs. And what Hamish is talking about is like, there's no ifs or buts about it. It is statistically proven that when the market is riding this a massive euphoric wave, IPOs go through the roof.
Yeah.
And conversely, when everyone's tight on cash, aka right now, IPOs, they just nothing. Like in 2008, IPOs, nothing.
Yeah.
A couple of years before, IPOs, right up here.
Mm. Yeah. And potentially, you know, I mean, you know, markets have been starting to improve. So like last year we saw, you know, things really roll off. So things are starting to improve. So I wonder if we'll see more IPOs throughout this year or whether there will just be kind of the odd large one kind of here and there. But there was a massive IPO. I think it was I'm not someone who watches the IPO market all that closely, but I think this is the biggest one in quite some time because it definitely caught the news cycle. A company called Carver did an IPO this week. It's a Mediterranean fast casual restaurant chain, which has been compared to Chipotle. So, you know, Chipotle has that, you know, kind of not self-service, but you kind of build your own burrito and bowl and that sort of thing. And this company does the same thing, but Mediterranean food, which is really interesting. And fast casual as a category in the restaurant space is the fastest growing category by far. It's kind of...
tell me more.
It's so fascinating. It's this mix between like...
I can understand why this has caught your attention.
God damn it.
You love these fast casual dining restaurant chains. I've been caught out. You love looking into them.
Well, yeah, it is interesting. I mean, so fast casual is kind of this combination of fast food and casual dining. So, you know, full service dining and fast food. It's kind of like in the middle. They essentially had a look at their S1 filing, which is the SEC filing that they have to make, which gives you kind of all of the initial details about the company. And sometimes you get some good information in the S1 filing, but a lot of the time it's just very surface level. And I'm never looking to invest in an IPO company because there just isn't enough data available for them yet. But I opened it up and the first 10 pages were pictures of food. So, you know, that was really helpful. I'm not kidding. 10 full,
of course.
10 full pages of food. So,
classic.
You know, they've got their marketing team working on
that. They're selling.
They're selling, which makes sense. I mean, look, it's the one time that you kind of excuse a company for going hard on selling, because it is actually good for the company if they do raise a lot of capital. So that's the one. You don't like a salesman, you know, CEO and that sort of thing. You don't like a fancy annual report that, you know, they've spent probably millions of dollars putting together. But when they're raising capital, you can kind of excuse it a little bit. But essentially, to give some details around the company, they were founded in 2006, so relatively new, and they will have 300 restaurants in 24 states of the US by the end of this year. So they have like 260 at the moment. But at their current run rate, they'll have about 300 open, so very, very small so far. They're not even in every state in the US, but certainly they can boast about their very, very good performance in the 17 odd years that they've been operating. They've had 50% per year compounded store growth, which is an incredible pace to be opening stores, especially when I talk about the return that they're getting on the capital they're deploying in those stores. They had 50% per year revenue growth, which for the company in total was $564 million in revenue. They have 20% restaurant level margins, which is very, very impressive. And then in terms of their target unit economics, they're pretty crazy. So they spend about $1.3 million in capital expenditure per store opening or per restaurant opening. And then by the end of the second year, on average, they're getting about $2.4 million in revenue per store, which means with their 20% restaurant margins, they're earning a 35% cash on cash return at the restaurant level, which is pretty insane.
Nice.
So to be able to deploy capital at a very fast rate, they're opening a lot of stores every single year and generate pretty high returns on that capital, is pretty impressive. So certainly, you know, they haven't had a long lifespan, but they're doing reasonably well. The negative side of this is they're not a profitable as a company yet. So they're losing $60 million a year. So at a restaurant level, if you exclude, you know, all of the company admin and marketing and the interest on the debt and all of that stuff, if you exclude all of that and just look at the restaurants, they're very profitable, but that's not...
That's, let's buy it, yeah, Hamish.
If you exclude all of this important stuff, that's the nature of a restaurant business, right? It's the restaurants, but it's also a business that needs a lot of admin to scale and to expand. So, they're not quite a profitable business yet. But at IPO, they raised $318 million at an IPO value of $2.45 billion. So, as I said,
sizable,
multi-billion dollar valuation. And yeah, I mean, the valuation is incredibly rich, which is not surprising Most IPOs tend to be that case. If you kind of run some basic numbers on it, you probably are modeling like double-digit growth for well over a decade. So you've got to be there's quite a significant amount of large expectation baked into the price of this business. But certainly interesting to see. The IPOs are back.
They are well one.
the IPO is back.
The IPO is back.
Yeah.
I had almost forgotten it existed, actually, though. I haven't heard of an IPO since, it's got to be a couple of years now.
Yeah.
It's funny how just, where are all those people? There were so many channels that were covering all the latest IPOs and they seem to have off into the distance. Where have they gone?
Yeah.
When are they coming back?
What happened to
I just type in best IPOs to buy 2023 and nothing comes up.
Do you remember Rivian?
Yeah.
Rivian IPO'd, I'm just looking at it now, they IPO'd at over $100 billion valuation. $100 billion. It's crazy. In 2021 as well.
Yeah.
And now they're worth $14 billion. And I think they've made a car. Have they made a car yet? No, we saw one. We saw the car that they made, right, in the US?
We saw a few.
We saw the two or three that they've made. They've made a few more than that. But it is just...
But still, it is a bit funny.
Yeah, that's always going to go down as being hilarious. That I think they had made, it was like 1,000 or 2,000 vehicles in total, and they had $100 billion valuation, which was just, that was definitely, what was that? Let me have a look at this. The end of, November 2021. That was basically peak insanity.
Peak speculation.
Yeah.
Absolute peak insanity. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're not wrong. Well, that's a very interesting sounding business, though. I guess this is it's definitely not one for my watch list, but it does sound like one for your watch list, Hamish. All right, and with that said, somehow we've been talking for 50 minutes, Hamish.
Mm.
I cannot believe that we've been talking for 50 minutes. The news this week was just so slow. Some of the stuff we've spoken about today I've found quite interesting. But let's finish off with some Q&A, hey?
Let's do it. Let me ask you. I'll give you this first one because I'm actually interested to see what your thoughts are on this. People who watch your channel, I can only imagine, are quite like-minded. You guys should start a forum in which you can, in which people can discuss value investing. I'd personally love to get a second opinion on some of my finds, and would be interested to see other people's ideas. Also, keep up the good work.
Mm. Yeah, I think this would be really cool. It's been done. It has been done. I think there's Value Investors Club is probably the most well-known kind of high quality. We're not talking about like, I don't know, what's like an American, but like it's not like a Facebook where you just go and shout some random washed opinion on a stock.
Yeah. I think
buy it. The stock's going up. Why? It's going up. Buy it. I would not want to create a platform that's like that.
I think that's the difficulty, right? You've got to strike a balance and it definitely needs to be heavily moderated to make sure the discussions are actually, fruitful.
Helpful.
And it is difficult to run something like that, but it would be interesting to have. And yeah, you're right. Like the Value Investors Club is kind of the other end of the extreme where it's incredibly exclusive, but the quality of the output is very high.
Yeah. Yeah. And Divya Narendra, who I spoke to on the channel a little while back, he has a similar platform, which is called Sum Zero. Does similar stuff, but I think a bit more wide ranging on topics than Value Investors Club, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, I would definitely. I think that would be really cool. It would be really handy. The problem is that most investors will not treat it like a value investing forum.
Yeah,
I would love it if they were all like everyone was really analytical. Everybody put their stuff out there and was asking for criticism, like shoot holes in my thoughts, but that's just not the way humans typically work. But I would like to, maybe one day I'll try something like that because I am very interested.
Yeah.
Because if it's done well, if it's done right, if you have the right community of people that are constructive and put good thoughts on there, then yeah, you could definitely create a very valuable resource, like a massive group of value investors that are all doing their own research and we're all actually watching out for each other. We're sharing ideas and we're also watching each other's backs, being like, hey, I've seen this. And then someone else could come along and be like, yeah, I noticed that too. Or another person could come along with, hey, but have you considered how much debt they've got? Or, you know, they don't have a long history of financial data, like poke holes in it in a respectful way. That would be really cool. But anyway.
100%.
All right, Hamish. Guess what?
What?
We're going overseas. We're taking a plane flight to India. What's your opinion on investing in the Indian stock market for the long term? I heard the Indian economy is booming.
Yeah, I mean, that's undeniable. It certainly is booming. And it's, it is interesting. It's certainly... it's certainly a place where there's a huge population of people that are going from that are moving into the middle class. It's got, I think, the fastest growing middle class, or in terms of size, a very fast growing middle class. So the next 30 to 50 years for India will be really, really interesting. I've never really considered looking to invest there. And the main reason why is it kind of goes back to what we were saying before about uncertainty. We're talking about crypto platforms and having uncertainty. And, I'm very cautious of investing in places where I don't understand the economic and especially the political situation. Not to say that India is a bad political situation or a bad economy to invest in, but I just don't know a whole lot about it.
Yeah, we just don't know.
In the same way that I don't know a whole lot about how the Chinese government operates and the impact that has on businesses. It's why I kind of tend to gravitate towards, well, first of all, the system and the country that I understand that I live in, but that system is very similar in the US and it's very similar in New Zealand and it's very similar in the UK. And there's some differences, but for the most part, kind of the fundamentals are the exact same. And that is the kind of the barrier that prevents me, or at least it's a level of uncertainty that I need to overcome if I'm to invest in a business, let's say in India or in Japan, for example. So that's where I sit on that. But, you know, assuming you have a good understanding of those things, then the rules, you know, for investing still apply the exact same way. Finding an incredible business with a deep moat around it, run by great people that you can buy at a discount. And the price is probably not going to be a concern in the Indian stock market because their stocks are likely to be, because of that uncertainty, they're likely to be quite cheap relative to fundamentals. So it's going to be much more of a focus on making sure the businesses you're investing in are really high quality businesses. And then how, as I said, kind of will they be or could they be affected by the political and economic system they operate in?
Yeah, I can't add anything. I agree with you totally. That it's just about where my competency lies, and it unfortunately does not lie in India. I don't really know of many Indian companies besides what Monish Pabrai has spoken about. I don't understand the politics. I've never been there. There's just a lot of unknowns for me, which make it... If I were to put any money in India, the way I would probably end up doing it would be through some sort of... Indian-focused, diversified fund if you wanted to make some sort of broad bet on the Indian economy. But even still, I don't think I'd do that because it's just not the way I go about my investing. So I think for me, it's a pass for now until I go there or learn more about it. But yeah, all the points you made, I agree with totally.
I think
that's it.
Do we have time for one more? No, we're that's it?
Oh, I reckon we just... Oh, we can do one more if you like. What one?
I'll give you this one. This is a quick one. What's your outlook on gold and silver as an investment?
Oh, okay. Well, it's not... Jeez. Okay, hang on. I've actually got 37 pages on gold and silver that I just prepared earlier. This is not a quick one at all. All right, page one, gold. No, I mean, it's the same as... I feel like we've answered this quite a few times, but, with any commodity, first of all, I don't claim to know what I'm talking about when it comes to commodities. So that's the first reason why I don't kind of invest in commodities. But gold and silver, what's the outlook? I don't know. They're things that people dig out of the ground and, it's worth whatever someone's willing to pay for it. you might say, oh, but a stock's just worth what someone's willing to pay for it. Yes, but there's a underlying cash flow that you can read about the business and determine why there's that level of cash flow and whether it's likely to grow over time. And that business has some sort of intrinsic value, whereas it's very hard to understand if a commodity does have an intrinsic value. Personally, I'd say it doesn't. I'm not saying that these things are not going to be valuable in the future. I think silver and gold have both been used as in financial markets a lot and or as financial assets a lot, and I think they will continue to be. But to know where what's going to happen to them or where they're going to go, I don't know. So I just don't touch them.
Yep. That's there's nothing really I can add to that. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Right.
As always, if you have any questions for next week's episode, please give us your questions. We need questions.
Yes.
So head over to the YouTube version of the podcast and click
on... We want questions.
No, we need them, okay? This is your homework. No.
Go and ask a question.
Write down 10 questions. And no. But you can head over to the YouTube version.
Helpful.
And you can ask your questions on the latest episode as a comment. Or if you're in Spotify, it's even easier. Just scroll up and you can ask your questions natively underneath the episode that you're listening to right now. But with that said, thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Thanks, Brandon, for joining me. And we'll see you guys next week. See you guys.